Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome to episode 102, where we will discuss the book My Years at General Motors by Alfred P. Sloan, Jr., originally published in 1963 by Doubleday. This is part one of the episode, where we will introduce this text that covers Sloan's personal experiences and decisions made over the course of almost 40 years as manager and then president, CEO, and board member of the General Motors Corporation from the 1920s to the early 1960s. To learn more about the text, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
Hi, this is Leonardo calling from São Paulo, Brazil.
Hi, this is Miranda calling from Leamington Spa in the UK.
Hey everyone, this is Rohan calling from London in the UK.
And this is Tom calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States. First and foremost, we'd like to welcome Rohan for joining us as a full-time cast member. You may recall that he joined us for our excellent treatment of the Manhattan Project back in episode 92, and we were so thrilled and pleased with how that episode came out and the tremendous reception it got that we've invited him back for to be a full-time cast member. So congratulations and welcome.
Thanks, Tom. Very excited to be part of the team.
You are most welcome. Okay, so today we have now surpassed Andrew Abbott for the largest book that we have tackled in this program. And this is My Years with General Motors by Alfred P. Sloan, Jr. This is a book that basically chronicles the early days of the General Motors Corporation from its time as its rather humble beginnings as a low-level competitor to Ford, which eventually and actually very quickly surpassed Ford in terms of market share, the diversity of the products that, you know, its automotive products, although it didn't just do automobiles, it did a lot of other things, but it eventually became the leading automotive producer in the United States. But it wasn't just during the 20s and the Depression. This story carries all the way to 1960. When he basically gave up the presidency, stayed on the board for a few years, and then eventually retired. So he was in a leadership position, a major leadership position in this corporation for the better part of four decades. It's a kind of part autobiography in that it talks about his decisions, his actions, what he wanted to do with the corporation. But it's also a treatise on the professionalization of business. And he says that very explicitly, that the purpose is not so much to tell his story, it's not all about him, but that it is something that should be used in business schools or management schools or something to teach others how to exercise management of their corporations. And he has some very, very strong views explained throughout the book on what it is that made things successful. With that, I would say that we concentrated much more on the autobiographical aspect because the book is neatly divided into two parts. Part one is the story, the timeline. And then part two is points of emphasis. It's like taking different particular problem areas, such as labor relations, such as pay, such as the desires to create or manage styling of the automobile over the decades. The part two is like more in depth on special topics. It's kind of repeats a lot of or reemphasizes a lot of the same things that were in part one. So I suspect we'll probably talk more about part one, but there are some stories in part two that are really worth expounding on. With that, I'd like to just go ahead and open the floor for initial impressions, and then we'll see where the conversation takes us.
Well, I will follow what you said. Remember my years studying the sociology of professions, and this is a very good example of what is a project of professionalization. It's interesting to look how Sloan's is trying to set one of the basics of the professionalization process, that is certain knowledge of that profession. He distinguished his role as a professional manager for a role of a CEO of the company, for example. Could manage everything. And this is because of a set of knowledge that he is developing along the book, I think. I want to quote him, if I may. The job of a professional manager is not to like people. It's not to change people. It is to put their strengths to work. This is something that you can apply everywhere, I think. I think that his main objective is to set this knowledge to others apply. It doesn't matter where you are. If you apply this kind of behavior, knowledge, you will succeed in management. I don't know if it, if it's working, if this worked well or work for him, of course. But it's interesting because there is a clear separation between someone who rules something and a manager. And I don't know if you guys succeed, if he think that he succeeded on that, but it's a clear effort of trying to establish what is the manager profession.
Yeah, sure. So my kind of initial take on it, very similar to what Leonardo just said, but another thing that I found very interesting was how much he discusses the structural aspects of the organization. It's almost, you know, it resonates a lot with kind of perhaps the classical organization theory and scholarship going on at that time in our domain as well. And he spends a lot of time thinking through, and we'll get into a lot of this, I'm sure, but thinking through these ideas of structure and of decentralization versus centralization. It got me thinking of, you know, another Alfred Chandler, whom I have not read, but who I'm sure covers similar terrain. But the other thing I found very interesting, and I just wanted to kind of mention at the outset, is for most of the book, he seems to set up these tensions and give us the resolution, saying this is what I did, this is what worked, you know, this is what the controls were, what the committees were, etc. But there are instances when you see that Sloan himself realizes some of this is irreducibly contradictory and paradoxical. And I found that quite interesting. And there's a quote that I kind of wanted to share from early in the book where, you know, at that abstract level before we discuss specifics, where Sloan says, regarding, you know, kind of these tensions of organizing, he says, its very contradiction is the crux of the matter. The language of organization has always suffered some want of words to express the true facts and circumstances of human interaction. One usually asserts one aspect or another of it at different times, such as the absolute independence of the part, and again, the need for coordination, and again, the concept of whole with a guiding center. Interaction, however, is the thing. So yeah, I found that quite illuminating.
I think building on that, sort of my just general reflection on the book is really that it feels like a description that is quite, to a certain extent, dry, or at least I read it as quite dry. So we've got the structure, you've got what happened, very analytical in that sense. But I think differently from a lot of the other books that we've read, especially those that were the product of perhaps some sort of field study or some sort of exploration of people, the people kind of, you know, they're not really there in their kind of differences and in their variety. And I thought it was important to highlight this, not particularly because it's a shortcoming and so on. I don't want to frame it in that way, but more because it's a really sort of analytical way of seeing the organization. And I think that's important to kind of frame it within the entire thread of organization studies. But I think also, I'm not sure when we'll get to it, but I felt that there was an acknowledgement from the author around how it's a description of how he did things and how things went. But at the same time, there were certain things that he had established that weren't, I think the quote is, they weren't the flavor anymore. They're kind of, it's a flavor that has gone out of fashion. That was it, in particular around what is the primary objective of the organization. So I felt there was a little bit of tension between, you know, I've done this. This is my memoir. This is my experience. But today things have gone a little bit differently, but not too much conversation there. So, yeah.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Miranda. And thanks. I think it was Leonardo for bringing up Chandler, or Rohan, you also brought up Chandler. We did Chandler in episode 74, and the contrast between that book and this book is kind of striking because, Chandler was referenced in Sloane's book because there was a relationship there. I'm not clear what it was. He didn't go into too much detail. But Chandler is the one who wrote the general history of industrial growth, and his was rich with examples and details. It was also a pretty lengthy book, but it was very interesting reading that sort of culminated with an idea of how do we solve the great problems of mass production and mass distribution? Well, this book is also covering that same general topic, just in a different fashion. You've centered on a particular corporation within an industry and focused on specifically their market share. What is that their decisions they're making of that corporation? But one other thing I will point out about Sloane's book that I found really refreshing. Yes, I can agree that it is a little on the dry side because it is highly objective. It's written very formal language. And everybody is referred to by Mr. as opposed to by their first name, which is a reflection of the time, of course. But one thing I did appreciate is that he kept, obviously, just about all of the personal memoranda and minutes and all of these things that he produced over the years. And he cites, basically pasted in, the actual text of those memos to justify and show, yes, I really did, no kidding, think this way, do this way, approach the problem this way. And ultimately, it grounded the story in real life. If he didn't do that, you'd just kind of think of this as somebody who's, you know, bloviating and making themselves sound like the king of the world. But that doesn't come across precisely because he gives evidence and he also offers, in some cases, some self-criticism. Although I think there are times when you felt like, you know, maybe he could have been a little bit more critical, more self-critical in some parts.
Yeah, I mean, I just to add to that, Tom, I think that is a pretty valuable aspect of this book, the amount of material, contemporaneous material that he's reproduced. And it's something that, you know, doing kind of historical work, I've come to appreciate, which is some books around that time are great records of primary sources where you've got a lot of material from the time. But it also really helps give you a sense of the setting. So there's some, at maybe chapter 2 or 3, I forget, but Sloane reproduces a lengthy letter that has nothing to do with him. The letter is between Pierre Dupont and Pierre's brother, Irene. And it shows you how these bankers are working behind the scene, kind of getting 3 hours of sleep, working out of a hotel in New York, trying to figure out what to do with General Motors. This was, I think, around 1919 or so. And I don't even know if Sloane meant to give such a great evocation of how work was happening behind the scenes, but the letter correspondence really brought that to life.
Chandler makes an interesting distinction, and it's between the empire builders and organization builders. So we have these founding members of the General Motors and other corporations, and you have this second generation of CEOs that Chandler is on. And one thing that he said is that what they have in common is that they have this engineering background. They are graduated from the universities. Sloane is a graduate from MIT. Chandler discussed how they have a more analytical way of approach the organization, the business, and how they are dealing with the difficulties of the 1920s in the United States, in, I think, the world as well. He mentioned a post-war depression that was starting to grow. So what I think it's telling us is the difference because it's professionalization of management, and he's trying to understand the reasons why you have this, the first generation of professional managers. And the book, it's a lot of personal conversation. It's a lot of details that he puts in. No other book on organizations goes on that level of detail of our organization, I think, of the running of organization. I never read a book like this. Even if you go to this more recent literature of CEOs, of startups, startup companies, tech companies, you don't get this near that details. Since the organization study, I think he's trying to put his ideas into work and maybe he succeed.
I think also just connecting back to that point around level of detail and knowledge of the information, despite my sort of feeling of being a bit drowned in a certain sort of area of knowledge that I'm not really that familiar with, I'll be honest. Cars isn't really my thing, and I kind of got lost with all of the details. However, I do appreciate that it was very clear that the person who was writing really knew what was happening. And I think this is an interesting point if you compare it to perhaps other stories of CEOs or other biographies. What do today's biographies sort of, where does the focus shift to? And is it because the CEO's interests are on other levels, which could be, or is it because they actually don't know and they've got other people that know, or they don't have that knowledge to be able to decipher that information? And I thought that was an interesting point to be able to picture who actually Sloan was. What kind of person are we talking about? What kind of person is talking through this detail?
Yeah, thanks, Hall. And I think, you know, perhaps now what we could do is turn our attention to the story itself and what happened over those 30 years. In essence, you know, trying to overly summarize, like I said, General Motors was a small player in what was a very, very new industry. You know, it's very easy for us to forget just how novel cars were, automotives were. In the late 1910s, when Sloan got involved in United Motors, and he wasn't a car person at that point, you know, somehow circumstances pulled him into this situation where he was working as a manager there. And then United Motors became subsumed under General Motors. And so Ford was the dominant player at the time. And Ford's philosophy, in part because of the increased efficiency of doing so, and also because there just wasn't a whole lot of other things available, you basically had one model that was all the same color. Everything was, you know, the Model T was the Model T, and there wasn't very much other options. And at the time, roads were still there were still a lot of unpaved roads. The road networks were not developed. The car at the time was kind of seen as more of a luxury. It was going to be used for sports or pleasure. It was not understood at that time the potential that it had to disrupt the social fabric of the country. It would become a very positive thing later, but initially it just wasn't seen as being more than just a curiosity for wealthier members. And so then he comes in, and GM is organized into different divisions, which are all happenstance. It's just basically a conglomeration of smaller companies that had just sort of formed to create this one sort of a diversified company. And there was no real sense of coordination. It was entirely decentralized. Each part was on its own. And so very early in the book, as they're about to come into what would be the first of several major crisis periods for the company, which was 1920, 1921, Sloan sets out to do a study, what he called the organization study. I mean, that's all it was called. It wasn't anything fancier than that. We would have had a whole marketing firm come up with names and stuff nowadays. But he basically lays out what would wind up being eventually his abiding philosophy of decentralization. Because even though GM would grow as a corporation, it would remain physically, structurally divided among different makes, of which each would produce its own automobiles. They would eventually, and it's interesting because GM, as far as just about anybody in my generation would remember, knows that GM has all of these different makes that are each stratified at different levels, according to those that are aimed at higher end users to those whose are the most economical. And that was not intentional until a couple of years after Sloan came into the firm. And so a big part of what he attributes to the company's ability to survive that first crisis period was the establishment of a proper division of these, I forget what he calls them, basically stratifying the products so that firms within GM were not competing against themselves.
Yeah, and we'll get into that more, but he calls that kind of having a concept of the market or a concept of the industry as well in terms of having that stratification. But I just want to say an important part of the backdrop is also William Durant. And there isn't much, so there aren't many parts in this book where Sloan gives up the protagonist role to other people. Pierre Dupont has that distinction at certain points and William Durant has it at an early stage. And the reason that's important is because the market before that was very much, there were a lot of players in the market, but everyone had their one product. You know, then Henry Ford comes in with the more kind of mass market Model T. But William Durant, who was at Buick at that time, had that earlier idea of having multiple models and multiple types. Then GM inherited as a legacy, to at least the kind of the germ of the idea. And the other reason I think that backdrop is interesting is because GM grew in a way that we would now call inorganic. It kind of grew through these kind of bringing in people under its umbrella, whether it was Buick or Oldsmobile or Oakland and others, United Motors. And so even Alfred Sloan came in through acquisition almost. And I think that's what kind of set the backdrop as well for Sloan's. So it was decentralized almost by default because it grew so inorganically. And then around, like you said, around 1919, 1920, Alfred Sloan had to do these intentional studies to figure out a way to make an organization out of what was just a constellation of parts.
And then following that, he chronicles what happened in the Depression years. And I think this is where he sort of touts the benefits of the model that he created, because it's what allowed him, it allowed his firm to survive what was a very tumultuous period of time in the Depression. He not only talks about how he changed the production of
the automobile,
but he also spent a lot of time talking about the governance, you know, basically how the managers were going to be organized. He had, at various different times, had created and disbanded committees. He created the financial committee. He created an executive committee. And this was all, in a way, trying to figure out how to make, you know, establish the central identity of the corporation, and yet throughout was very careful not to take away too much power away from the divisions. What he was trying to do was trying to get the divisions to cooperate with each other, because the divisions were stovepiped. And so they had the total control over the products that they delivered and their relations with dealers and the customers, et cetera. And so what he wanted to do was to, you know, again, make sure that they weren't competing with each other, going after the same markets, but also to try to find efficiencies by working more closely together to get different makes to follow along with some common chassis designs, for example, in order to make the corporation as a whole more efficient and yet still retain the separate identities of these different divisions. He also had created committees that got into styling. As the tastes of people started to diversify with different types of cars, different types of features that they wanted, he wanted to make sure that there's still somewhat of a GM identity over how the styles were managed, so that it wasn't all everybody coming up with things that would cause problems for the engineers trying to take these style ideas and put them into practice.
What he did was to develop a structure to coordinate information, trying to compete with Ford with this different concept of how things should be managed. It's one of the criticism, a soft criticism that he said is holding Durant into a conversation, because he has the vision, but not the skills to manage all the GM. He, I think, is always is critical about his management styles. He says that it's a kind of someone who is not tough enough, I think, to run all the thing. And what he did is to create this structure to set some standards and some patterns of operation. And this is the thing that he wanted to do, coordinate information. And what the organization study that you mentioned, that he did, was to maybe put these patterns of information working, I don't know, if, and all conflicts that comes along with this change of structure. He spent a lot of time in the book talking about how to make these different committees, these different departments of the organization to work. So even though the idea of information coordination is a kind of theoretical one, when you put into practice, a lot of conflicts arise, and he spent a lot of time talking about this.
Yeah, I mean, for me, definitely, I would call it even one of the headline themes of the book, which was just information and control. And you know, keeping those distinct, where his first task was just to have good data on the organization. And his issue with Will Durant was basically one of rationality. And are you impulsive or are you fact-based, evidence-based? And he seems to have taken great pride in being rational. And he uses literally those words. And so the first step was just to get a sense of a comparative sense of how the business is doing. And then later it gets more and more sophisticated in terms of demanding reports from the different divisions, and then starting to actually demand go from kind of what we would again today call leading versus lagging indicators. So go from just your operations to start forecasting as well. And then there's the control element. And I think that's where for Sloan, there's a distinction where you can still maintain, let them kind of maintain divisional autonomy as long as there's information flowing correctly, and then intervene. Well, A, you have a policy and governance, but B, you intervene to act on that information as and when needed. And so coming back to, I guess, where we are in the timeline, his main challenge in around 1920, when he was writing up this report, wasn't just setting up the structures for this to take place.
One of the examples of this, Rory, is that the largest chapter, and I think the most important one, is the development of financial controls. He spent a lot of time talking about market projections, how they develop this kind of data collection on market patterns in the United States, so how this is important. And I think most important of all, the development of the return on investments. This kind of statistical control and economic analysis was something that certainly, I think he is the man who really developed this in terms of in a corporation. So departments that are, I think everybody in the organization kind of had that in mind, because he's talking about this every time, especially when you're talking about innovation and research. This is something that they got to have in mind, their return of investment. So it's a very important development.
I just wanted to maybe sort of just open the conversation around what your thoughts were of Sloan as a person, because I feel I approach this book sort of expecting a biography because of the title, My Years with General Motors, and it felt, you know, my years in Hollywood or whatever sort of my years you want to sort of invent around that one. And I met instead a little bit of biography, but I met a lot more around the organization, the decisions, the experience of bringing this organization, which I imagine was particularly messy, particularly chaotic, to a more structured way. But I was also just asking myself, okay, who is Sloan and what do we know about him? And I think what emerged, at least in my mind, was that he devoted clearly a lot of time to this place. There's a point where he says, you know, I took time off, or I went to the UK and I was going to buy a Rolls Royce or something. But I wanted to take time to think about what to do. And you think about somebody who's extremely invested, as if they'd created it, even though that really wasn't the case. Perhaps he'd created what was there, but he hadn't really sort of, it's not the story of a founding business owner. At the same time, there's a point where he talks about his shares, in particular around the slump of 1920, I believe. And that's a point where I remember him saying something along the lines of there was a decision perhaps to sell off the shares, but he was going to stick with them. So I don't know. It was an interesting one, how he presents himself, how he portrays, on the one hand, somebody who's really interested, even more than interested, in this business. But I feel it goes beyond the financial element, because it did feel, even if it wasn't there, and maybe it's me reading between the lines, that there was something more in terms of attachment to this organization.
I'll take a first stab, because this is a ghost-written book. there's all sorts of variety in terms of the relationship between a ghostwriter and the author, the subject. And I know it's ghostwritten because I was probably going to bring this up anyway. The John McDonald, who was the ghostwriter for this, he isn't mentioned, I don't think, on the cover or anything. But John McDonald actually wrote a separate book about how this book was written, which I won't get into now. Maybe we'll get into later. You know, one of the challenges when you're trying to decide upon how much or what it is that you want to present of yourself in a book, whether it's yourself writing it yourself or if it's ghostwritten for you, you know, what's the overall purpose behind the book? I would be very surprised if he was, if his objective, rational personality didn't come across in himself in real life. But there's a lot of cases in which he summarizes certain episodes, particularly negative ones, like in part two, when he talks about labor relations and the conflicts he had with the unions, as the unions were starting to grow more powerful in the 1930s and starting to try to impose themselves upon management at that time, he dismissed their concerns as irrational, unsound. There were several other rather formal terms he used, which I suspect are not the same terms he would use if we were sharing a bottle of a glass of whiskey with each other in his office, shall we say. Intense, I would almost have to assume that there's a certain intensity to it, because you don't retain a lot of objective knowledge unless that really gives you an emotional sense of being. Okay? If that's something that makes, that justifies who you are and what you're doing, and it's rational, empirical like that, that translates very well into very intense, rational, empirical approaches to just about everything that you do. And even, like, for example, his stories with Kettering, Mr. Kettering, when he's talking about him as one of those who's going to be the innovator, he really welcomed a lot of the innovations that Mr. Kettering brought as sort of like the freewheeling, experimental, innovative type of a person. But at the same time, Sloan was not shy in this book about rebuking Kettering for some of his wilder ideas that did not come out terribly soundly. So, yeah, I have this picture of somebody who is just a very intense, very strong, stiff upper lip type of a person.
Just remember that one quote from, not a quote, but one passage from Chandler that Durand was called Bill on the factory, and Sloan in his years in General Motors was always called Mr. Sloan. So maybe this is an example of the difference between the personalities of these two runners of the General Motors.
Yeah, I mean, just to add to these things, I think, so I didn't realize it was ghostwritten, so then that of course makes it harder to interpret or read between the lines, but it is fair to say, having gone through the book, that a lot of the rationality that he's espousing was probably, he probably enacted it on a day-to-day basis, at least in public. Again, different over a bottle of whiskey, I'm sure. And to Miranda's point, some of the dryness, I think, well, some of it might be off the time when you're trying to write in a kind of apersonal manner. But some of it, I would expect it to actually reflect his style and his way. And I think that anecdote you shared, Leonardo, is spot on, where you can, you know, you call William Bill, but you call Alfred Mr. Sloan. Yeah.
I think I'll add one other thing when it comes to how he refers to the people. And this becomes apparent when you go to the, I think it was one of the later chapters on incentives and the incentive structure. He's talking exclusively about managers. And pretty much throughout the book, he makes only passing references to the workers themselves. But his concentration is on the other executives of the firm, who he sees as the ones who he is chartered to develop, whose responsibility he feels himself to establish systems to determine bonus pays and all of this sort of thing. And so there's also a tremendous, you know, in line with what you just said, Rowan, about the way that he referred to himself in a rather formal sense, it also reflects power distance. It's hierarchical or stratified, but there's a gulf between the leaders and the led. It's a very different world. And I guess, you know, again, this is probably more a product of its time, perhaps a bit more a product of industrial versus today more informational type corporations, where we've seen a lot of successful companies that didn't use or didn't instill that level of power distance and benefited from it. Here, because we're talking about really hard labor and a lot of uncertainty, I mean, we have to also remember a lot of the reasons why he wants to put these controls in is because of the uncertainty surrounding what is the market going to ask for from one year to the next. And yet it takes, you know, he figured out that it takes a couple of years in order to be able to, say, develop a new style for a car. And he's worried about what happens if the consumer demands change between now and then. So that's also kind of calls for a certain amount of intensity, a certain amount of rationalism in order to be able to try to stay ahead of that and accept the fact that sometimes you're going to get it wrong or you're going to face reverses.
But yeah, and to put it in more colorful terms and to go back to Miranda's original question is, what do you think of Sloan as you read this book? He feels like someone who was born in the boardroom. So not someone who, you know, hasn't had a childhood, wasn't, you know, an undergrad freshman in college. He was never middle management, struggling to upwardly manage. He's always an executive and trying to impose his will and his authority and working on kind of orchestrating things around him.
But I think there's interest based on what Horin said. It's authority. And it kept my attention, something that he said in the book, that he had the best results, not when you are telling people what to do, but when he got people to trust, kind of trust him, what he's saying to what they have to do. Well, I don't know if he got this kind of leadership. And he said that in this position of manager, you have to have leadership as performance. So if you perform well, you will be a good leader and people will, in a certain way, believe in what you're doing. In other accounts that I read, people say that he was a very gentle man, not a kind of a toxic leadership, let's say this way. But I don't know if this, as Tom says, a ghost write book. I don't know if people, because you are the boss. If you are telling people what to do, they will do it. I think he avoids this kind of characteristics. They're saying that all the committees will have this discussion. We have a kind of democracy here. But in the end, the final word is mine. But he doesn't say like this because he always stressing how he is always talking, always trying to convince people to do things and trying to sell his ideas, not to impose them.
Yeah, perhaps one other aspect of his character that that did impress me in the book, especially knowing when, you know, the time period that we're talking about, is that he traveled a lot and talked about how he made regular visits to the divisions and regular committee meetings. He set up the structure, but he also abided by it and made it clear that he wasn't going to sit in his corporate headquarters and dictate, you know, from the ivory tower. He got out there to see eyes on target, as it's kind of a phrase we like to use, to actually see what is going on in there, you know, from themselves, and talk face to face with his division leaders, so that he always felt like he had more of a, you know, a real understanding of what was going on. Now, to what extent did the organization fall into certain behavior patterns of which they covered themselves and, you know, made themselves look good every single time he went around because this was the big boss and people tend to do that? We won't get that sense from the book, you know, because again, it is still an autobiography, and a certain amount of third person perspective would uncover some of those other aspects.
Yeah. And I think to put it in kind of our current management theory terms, this is a bit of an upper echelons book where it's more about how he's, let's say, stopping over appropriation of funds from the VPs of each each division, as opposed to further down the line, so to speak. And I know, for example, in a previous episode, we've talked about Melville Dalton's book. There you see much more of kind of how people bottom up respond to these new policies. And these, I'm sure, for example, the reporting requirements would have been quite onerous to do all this forecasting on a monthly basis, update it with a 4-month outlook. But we get no sense from Sloan of the other perspective. And I wanted to share, because there's a great mini anecdote in the book. It's in the chapter on financial controls, which shows you how, to what extent, I would say it's a contrasting example of how the book actually doesn't cover much of these, except for this one instance where Sloan is talking about cash controls across the divisions. And he gives an example of how Buick used to be the most cash-rich division, and the central treasurer, so I think his name was Mr. Prentice, would have no visibility on how much money they have. And I think let me quote this directly. And then Sloan says, there was a cat and mouse game between headquarters and Buick, because long experience had made Buick's financial staff highly adept at delaying its report of the cash they had on hand. And then Sloan goes on to paint a lovely picture of how, for example, then what would happen in reality is Mr. Prentice, the central treasurer, would form his own estimate of how much cash that division has. And he would show up on site. And he would then discuss all the other agenda items before then, again, using Sloan's word, at last casually bringing up the subject of cash. Buick's financial people would invariably express surprise at the size of Mr. Prentice's request, and occasionally would try to resist the transfer of such a large amount. So that little anecdote of how these things actually worked reminded me, in fact, of the Dalton book. And I think it's fair to say that we can assume such richness would have been there on the ground, but Sloan is not giving us that perspective. He's focused more on essentially on the rationality of his policy design and then how he executed the design.
You were talking, I was remember Max Weber, when he was talking about charismatic and rationality, charismatic authority and rational authority. I have a feeling that Sloan was not charismatic at all. But his primary objective is how you can develop a rational authority over your organization. Everybody will abide that because it's the right way to do things. And this is a discussion that goes back, as I mentioned, Max Weber to today. So it depends on the side, depends on the effectiveness of this. I think he wrote a great statement on how to apply rational authority on organization.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. And if so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.